Hello world! Welcome to the Personal Computer Show, the original personal computer radio show. Joining me this evening is Joe King. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI 99.5 FM, New York. This broadcast is pre-recorded. We are not taking telephone calls this evening. Solid-state drives are expected to jump soon, and if not, has already done so. For the last few years, solid-state drives have been falling steadily thanks to the increased NAND production by multiple companies and the transition to 3D NAND, which offers vastly increased densities for much lower cost per bit. That trend is expected, however, to take a big hit now, with significant price increases. Contract prices for flash drives are expected to rise by 6 to 10%. If you're planning to buy a solid-state drive for Christmas, do it now. In other words, if you want to do it later, it will just cost you 6 to 10% more. Intel is about to step back from wearables in a big way. So where are we today with wearable technology? In 2014, the company purchased Basis, a little-known producer of some truly excellent fitness watches. The acquisition was folded into the brand NDG, New Devices Group. In June of 2015, Intel picked up Recon, makers of wearable heads-up displays for cyclists, snowboarders, and the like. This summer, however, cracks began to show in the company's wearable plans. In June, Intel recalled Basis Peak devices due to overheating concerns. Rather than replacing the units, the company simply stopped all sales of the devices, and Intel took it a step further and shut down the Peak's software support, including cloud storage, effective by this year end. Now Intel is planning to take a major step back from its investment, or possibly even exit wearables altogether. The changes will include a large number of layoffs in NDG, along with a larger new technologies group into which it was folded into in April of this year. It's a move already viewed at the time by many as an early sign of Intel's displeasure with its wearables division. The company has already informed a number of employees about the changes, with many expected to lose their jobs before the year end. Reports thus far has been varied, but all points to a larger job loss for those in NDG and the possible shutdown of the group altogether. Along with the layoffs, the move likely means that much of NDG's work will never see the light of day, including Basis Ruby, an unannounced fitness watch, which at the very least might have helped buoy the companies following the unceremonious death of the Peak. So where are we today with wearable technology?
The big thing in home computing is what they're calling wearable tech. And you know, you just told us that Intel is about to close that whole division. And yet, that's probably the biggest new thing on the horizon. And I would imagine, nobody told me this, but this Christmas, anybody interested in computing is going to end up with some form of wearable tech, whether it's wristwatch, which keeps record of your life, or it's something with weight control or cardiac situation. This has become the very big thing. Marty Winston had some very interesting thoughts on it regarding privacy. Now, some people would say Marty's being paranoid, and other people would say, well, that's a very sensible way of looking at things. Let's hear what he has to say about it.
This is Marty Winston. We should talk about wearables. Are you a physician? Are you a nurse? Are you a physical trainer? Are you a physiologist? Do you have any idea of what to do with information that comes from wearable tech? It might be fairly accurate at measuring your blood pressure, your heartbeat, the steps you take, that kind of thing. But what do you do with the data, really? I mean, it's not like it's interpreting it for you. So unless you're a professional who's used to dealing with the data, you're taking health-related data and putting it in the hands of amateurs, like most of you, like me. How many steps did you take today? How many calories did you eat? How much was your workout? And what do you do if you know? Hey, look, I've got a thing that shows me my pulse rate, but it's only at 68. I'm going to get that thing up to 150. And bang, you're dead. That's the danger of trusting too much in tech. Let's start with most wearables that take any kind of data from your body. any kind at all, most wearables are inaccurate, even where they are accurate, and you can't at first sight tell that which is from that which isn't. Even if they are accurate, the data it gives you is not necessarily something on which you can or should act. If you have a concern about your health, strapping a $200 thing on your wrist to watch it on a smartphone is not good use of your assets or your resources. Spend less money. Go to a doctor. Get blood tests or cardio tests or whatever tests you need and find out the truth. When have you gone to a doctor that they haven't taken your blood pressure, your weight, your height, your heartbeat? That's important information. It tells them a lot. It's the first sign of trouble. It's the little yellow flags of your health. The thing on your wrist that says, "You've got 10,000 steps today," is not a doctor. It's barely a pedometer. What is it? Why do you want it? Personal challenges? It's not your personal best? Tell you what, go to the gym, pick up a 20-pound weight, and curl it. Can you do it 10 times, 20 times, 50 times, 1,000 times? There's something that you don't wear that still tells you the result. Are your arms sore when you're done? Can you still move around? Are you still fitting your shirts? These are real-life examples of what's involved in the things that wearables are trying to tell you. But there's another whole layer on this that also deserves your attention. I just got in a pre-release, so it's not yet on the market, but it's about to be. A pre-release wearable, essentially, watch. And I have to tell you, it does some things that are downright rude. It wants access to all of your contacts, to your storage. It wants access to your position. It wants access to things that could, you know, SMS and email. It wants to be able to know way too much. I've got privacy concerns, major privacy concerns, when something can be that intrusive. And then when you run the app, it wants to know everything you've eaten today. It wants to know every exercise you've done, every step you've taken. It's measuring some. It's not measuring some. And then it's going to tell you what you should do. This is worse than a domineering mother. This is worse than a nagging spouse. This is something that is technology that you paid for, turning itself into the boss and you into the submissive, saying, "Oh, yes, I forgot to add that raise, and there's another 14 calories. Really? Is that what your life is about? Are you getting this for recreation? For the amount you pay on this, spend a week with a real trainer. Spend a week with a pro. Go to a doctor's office. Have the tests made. Find out if you're healthy. The stethoscope on trained ears tells more than any wearable you can possibly own. Wearables are scary. And wearables are something you should stay away from. And let me go another scary route here. You know what's really scary? Social media. "Oh, no, no, don't take my social media away." Hey, listen. There is, I'll include 911 in this. There is no thing that has been more detrimental to American productivity than social media. It is an unproductive time vampire. It draws your time, it draws your attention, it draws your ability to concentrate into things that are largely vacuous or trivial. Why are we putting up with it? Why are we dealing with, "Oh, look, somebody commented on their picture. Oh, look, I got a like. Oh, I got a dislike." Why are we dealing? Why do we care about that? If you want tweets, you know, go have fun. But you're not in junior high anymore. Middle school stuff. Okay, okay. "You know what they said at that lunch table about you, right?" You know, this is not what life is about. If you can turn off social media, what are you out? You know, I'll make an exception. People are checking up on you. You can have all kinds of junk on Facebook, and they're going to believe most of it. Pay attention to LinkedIn. You know, if it's professional, they'll go to LinkedIn. They'll see what other people say about you and what you say about yourself. And it may or may not jive with how you presented yourself. But your whole footprint across social media and online is part of how you're defined, not always by yourself, about how you're defined today. So, two scary things. Wearable tech, social media. Let me mention one more. And this goes back to the home automation we've been talking about. In our project, our editorial project house, our 40-year house, 40yearhouse.com, one of the principles we laid down, and one I would ask you to consider, we're not allowing video cameras pointing indoors or being indoors. There are no indoor cameras. There's a ring of cameras surrounding the house, and they slightly overlap, so we have full perimeter surveillance. There is an NVR system that triggers when anything comes into view in one of those cameras. So we can do things like, as you walk into a zone that's being watered, we can turn the water off way across the zone. That's not even hard. But cameras that point inside the house, even to some extent what we're doing, will tell somebody if you're home or not. We'll tell somebody who's home or not. If it's a good high-resolution camera, it may let them read your bank account information from statements that come in the mail or look over your shoulder on what's on your notebook or your tablet. It's not a good thing. It's really not helping anything. Okay, you've got latchkey kids, and you want to make sure they make it home okay. There are other ways to do that. You know, have them Skype you from home. You can see what's in the background. You pick up on that call. It happens at modestly random times, and you know it's them, and you know it's done. Done. You know, you're in a meeting. They can still send you a Skype message. You're still doing the same thing. Take a snapshot. Here I am. I'm home, Mom. It's okay. You have a date on it. You have a time on it. You know they're not fibbing or exaggerating. But having a surveillance camera, a nanny cam, a spy camera in the house invites those very talented Russian hackers to know way too much about what's happening indoors, to deal with invasion of privacy, identity theft, and things you don't want to happen. Outdoors, I have very little problem. But even there, I'm taking one more step that I, again, would invite you to consider. I'm not taking outdoor surveillance for the purpose of remotely monitoring my house on a phone. I'm taking outdoor surveillance so that when activity happens and pixel shifts, changes in the picture, things that are happening because they're happening, hope that's not too circular, can trigger an NVR, and I'm building my own, it's just a computer, a Blue Iris software, like it. Things that are happening get the computer to record what's happening. It's not a before-the-fact or time-of-activity kind of security system. It's a surveillance system. Somebody comes up to my yard and throws eggs on the window, I'm going to have his picture probably 15 different times. I can take that picture to the police and get somebody else to clean that window. That's what surveillance is about. Security is having a lock on the door, is having a dog in the house, having a gun, if you believe that that's something you can and should do. So, when you're considering home automation involving cameras, don't put them inside. Don't hook them up to the cloud. Again, we have ours on a network. In fact, it's a different network than our controllers are on. We have ours on a network that, like our controllers, is not allowed cloud WAN, wide area network access. It's only allowed access among each other and with the NVR, the network video recorder that records their video. That means we have the assets we need. We have surveillance that can be useful. We have another set of triggers for our automation, and we don't have a door or window into the house for hackers who might find evil ways to put that information to use.
Well, that was one way of looking at things. Marty's a very wise person when it comes to the marketplace and to the technology developments. But Alfred Poor, yes, that's our Dr. Alfred Poor, is an expert in a different way. He uses and evaluates wearable tech, not from the point of view of privacy and not from the point of view of identity theft, but from the point of view of usability and what it can do for you. It's a very different point of view from what Marty has just said. Alfred has looked at it from a different point of view entirely. From the medical point of view, and remember that medical equipment evaluated very differently from what personal computing would concern itself with. My doctor, for example, gave me certain levels, pulse rate, certain levels of my oxygen, blood oxygen level, certain other factors, and he said when I'm at the gym exercising, I shouldn't go beyond this, and I shouldn't go beyond that, and I should look at this, and I should look at that. suddenly the exercise in the gym no longer becomes a comforting, relaxing experience. Now it's suddenly another visit to the hospital, to the doctor's office. But how do I get these levels? How do I get the pulse rate? Fine. The machine that I'm exercising on gives me the pulse rate. The blood pressure? No, it doesn't do that. And the serum oxygen level, it certainly doesn't do that. So I have to go out and buy wearable tech, which gives me those things. Now, the problem there, as Alfred points out, is that if they're not approved by the FDA, then you can't be sure of their accuracy. Let's listen to what he has to say on this matter.
This is Alfred Port, editor of Health Tech Insider, bringing you news about wearable technology in health and medical applications, as well as the technologies that make these new devices and applications possible. The first story I want to cover today is about how to help patients stick to their treatment plans more reliably. Anybody who's on a maintenance medication knows that, you know, you're going to miss a dose from time to time. Or if you're given exercises by your physical therapist, there may come times when you don't get around to doing the exercises you're supposed to. Estimates say that failures of patients to follow their treatment plans can cost as much as $290 billion, billion with a big B, $290 billion each year in extra healthcare costs just in the U.S. How can we help patients do a better job of sticking to the treatments that have been given by their healthcare professionals? A new study has shown that when you have remote health management tools, patients show significantly improved adherence to their treatment plans. A recent study with over 125,000 patients tracked and they discovered, reported their performance, stored the data in the cloud so their physicians and other healthcare professionals could refer to it. They found that adherence way, way up when using the connected device. In general, adherence can be as low as 50%. But with the monitoring devices, rose to 87% of compliance with the connected devices. The Internet of Things could have a huge impact on our healthcare, helping us to stick to the treatment plans that our physicians give us. In so doing, make the treatment much more effective and save billions of dollars for the healthcare industry as a result. In another story related to the healthcare industry, let me ask you a question. Do you have a Social Security number? I imagine most people listening to this show are going to say yes, but the second question is, are you the only one using that number? And you may be surprised, 6% or more of the U.S. residents have two or more Social Security numbers associated with their names. And an amazing 40 million Social Security numbers are associated with more than one person. Part of this is just from people changing names and not updating their records correctly. Some of it's due to identity theft. But whatever the cause is, the Social Security number is no longer the gold standard in personal identification. That can be a nuisance or even a problem when you're dealing with things like personal finance and banking and insurance and things like that. But it becomes a crisis when you're talking about medical records. If your medical records are stored under two different identities, doctors may not know everything about you that they need to know in order to treat you effectively. If your medical records get scrambled with somebody else's because you're both using the same Social Security number, the problems can become even worse. One of the big challenges for modern healthcare is to come up with digitizing so much more information about individuals. We're tracking a lot more information, and healthcare records are now kept electronically. But all this information is no good if we can't be sure that we're talking about the right person when we're looking at medical records. One of the big challenges is coming up with a medical ID that is going to be effective and unique to the individual. One company's come up with a clever solution to it. They don't use fingerprints. They don't use retina scans or something complicated like that. They use a scan of your palm, but they don't look at the palm print. What they do is they use infrared light to scan the veins in your hand. And as it turns out, pattern of the veins in your palm are unique to each individual. You can't fake it. You can't steal it easily, which makes it a much more secure way of identifying a patient. And all the patient has to do is just lay their hand on a scanner to be quickly and uniquely identified. This obviously isn't going to work in all circumstances, but it's a possible way forward to help us be sure that when doctor is looking at a certain patient's records, they can be sure that individual who they're trying to treat is matched up with the health records that they're reviewing. An important solution to a big problem. One of the problems that people with prosthetic limbs or who are paralyzed due to a spinal injury One of the problems they have is that they don't get any feedback either from their prosthetic limb or their paralyzed limbs, and they need that sense of touch to let them know where their hand or foot is positioned and the pressure that's on it and so forth in order to be able to function more normally. A number of different groups are working on solving this problem. One of the interesting developments has been done at the experiments that have been done at the University of Washington, where they directly stimulate the brain to provide feedback from an artificial limb, say a mechanical hand. It's not a total replacement for the sense of touch. In other words, it doesn't necessarily register as touch, but what it is a set of sensations that a patient can learn in order to correlate to movement and touch and provide feedback on the position of their limb or their hand or whatever. The way they did this was created a matrix of electrodes that could both sense the brain activity, but that could also stimulate the brain in specific locations. You would think this is a bit invasive and extreme to do as an experiment with a human subject. But as a matter of fact, they had easy access to people for just this kind of application. As it turns out, patients with extreme epilepsy often undergo a operation in their brain to try to disconnect the areas of the brain that are the source of their seizures. They do this by implanting a matrix of sensors like that I've described. What this study did, the researchers approached these epileptic patients who had this implant put in for a short period of time to help map out where their seizures come from, asked them to volunteer for this program, and a number of subjects did, and so they were able to use a digitized glove, and they blindfolded the patients, and glove movements caused stimulation of the brain, and they were able to correlate the movements of their hands with the sensation they had in their brain. Very quickly learned to be able to position their hand the way they were asked to in direct response to the stimulation that they were getting from their brain. They found that if they made random stimulation rather than correlate it to the hand movement, they weren't as successful at following commands. So it showed that there really was a way that they could artificially stimulate the brain to replace the sense of touch and motion and position. It would be absent with a prosthetic limb or a paralyzed limb that was like from a spinal injury. So this is a real step forward for closing the loop to move an artificial hand or limb and sending back feedback as to what the results of that motion was. This could have huge impact in the future for paralyzed patients or patients who've lost limbs and have them replaced with a powered prosthetic device. Speaking about paralysis, one of the big problems for paralyzed patients is to connect that broken communication channel between the brain and the rest of the body when the spinal cord is severed. Some Swiss scientists have come up with an interesting experiment. They used a wireless brain-body connection. What they did was they implanted a sensor in the brain, and then that sensor transmits signals wirelessly to a controller can stimulate the muscles of a limb. In this case, in their experiment, they connect the brain of a monkey whose spinal cord had been severed to their leg, and the monkey was able to regain control of that leg and learn to walk again in as little as 6 days. There are no wires going from the brain to the leg. It's just a wireless connection that's made between the two. This is a very exciting development because in the future, this could help people who are currently wheelchair bound and unable to walk. This could allow them for their brain to take control of their body again so they could walk again. One of the common elements of most wearable devices is that they're getting smaller and smaller, which is important because that way they use less power, they're less intrusive, we don't have to fuss with them, they sort of disappear into our lives. But it raises a big issue. How do you control those tiny devices? As they get smaller and smaller, even if they have a screen, it gets too small for you to use as a touch screen. If the device gets too small to have buttons on it that you can reach and control effectively. So how can we control these tiny little devices? Researchers at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh have come up with an interesting solution. Using a standard smartwatch, they added a simple controller that can detect proximity electrically. And the fascinating thing about this is it uses an off-the-shelf device that costs about $5. So it would not cost a great deal to incorporate this into a smartwatch or any other kind of wearable device. It uses tiny little antennas that are embedded in the device, which can sense when the user's hand is getting closer or further from the device. If you've ever seen a theremin, that musical instrument that you control by waving your hands at it, it works on the similar principle. And so with this, if you had, a smartwatch, you could control it by actually tapping your arm in the vicinity of the watch. It gives you a much larger area of control than just the watch itself. And in fact, you can also do swiping motions, pinch motions. There's a lot of different kinds of gestures that could easily be identified. In fact, it's even possible for the sensors to recognize the position of the hand that you're wearing the watch on. So, you know, if you're wearing it on your left hand, if you raise or lower your hand, you can use that to control the device as well. This is a very exciting development because it means that we could have very low cost, and easy to learn interfaces for these smaller and smaller devices. And we would be able to control them without having to resort to touch screens or buttons or physical devices like that. One of the important details about wearable technology is that if it's going to be widely accepted, it's going to have to be durable, and it's going to have to be easy to produce, and it's going to have to be low cost. Now, printed electronics holds forth a great promise on all three counts because you can use flexible inks as conductors, and they can be low cost because you only print the circuits where you need them, so at very low material costs. One of the problems there is durability. If circuits should get broken, there's no easy way to repair it. Researchers at University of California in San Diego may have a solution. What they've done is they've actually embedded magnetic particles in the ink, in the conductive ink that they can use to print circuits. And so what happens is they figured out a way to make those magnetic particles align as they're printed so that the magnetic field runs in the same direction. If that circuit gets broken, magnetic particles attract to each other. And in fact, the two sides can automatically reconnect themselves. They've shown in experiments that a 3-millimeter gap, which is kind of big in terms of an electronic circuit, 3-millimeter gap can close up again in 0.05 of a second. 0.05 of a second, which is extremely quick. So having an ink that could, if it's cracked or cut, that would be able to pull itself together and close that gap could be a big boon to the development of printed wearable devices. Those are just some of the stories we cover on Health Tech Insider. It's a free website, and if you'd like, you can sign up for our free weekly newsletter as well. Just go to www.healthtechinsider.com. And if you have any questions, you can email me at alfred@healthtechinsider.com. Thanks a lot for listening, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Now, that was extremely interesting, but does it change your mind in any way between listening to Marty Winston and Dr. Alfred Poor? Does it change your mind on what you're going to buy or give or get this holiday season? It certainly did with me. I took something that I had received for my birthday over to the doctor's office, and he tested it, in a sense, by having a blood pressure and pulse meter on my left arm and having this wristwatch-type thing on my right arm. And they came in pretty close together, I would say under 10% differential. He pointed out to me that that 10% might be the cause of a heart attack, it might be the cause of a stroke, and if he wanted something really accurate, he wants it to be accurate. Now, he said to me, do I understand what the difference is between the different numbers? And I said, certainly, that's my pulse rate, and that's my breathing rate, and that's how much, what percentage of oxygen is in my bloodstream. And he said, yeah, what do those things mean? And I stared at him, and I realized, as well-read as I might be, I don't really know what they are. And so Marty is quite right in that regard. Alfred, on the other hand, is more concerned with the metering than the understanding of the metering. I don't know. It's a difficult question.
A short break for public service announcements. The New York Amateur Computer Club will be meeting Thursday, December 8th at 7 p.m., and the presentation is Thoroughly Modern MIDI. It's a presentation on MIDI music at NYU 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, Room 414. The Rockland PC Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, December the 13th at 7:15 p.m. at the Rasa Room on the fourth floor of the Palisades Moor at West Nyack, New York. There's been a change in the normal meeting time and the meeting date and the meeting location of the Brookdale Computer Users Group. They will have a presentation on drones, how we got there, and how it all works. They will be meeting at the Middletown Library at 6:45 p.m., and it's on a Monday, December the 19th. All these notices are open to the public, and there is no admission expense. To get your group's events mentioned on the show, send us an email at pcradio@gmail.com and give us the name of your computer organization, topic of presentation, date and time of the meeting, its venue, and room number if it's applicable. Last month, China passed a tough cybersecurity law that will, among other things, require any technology company doing business in the Asian superpower market to submit their designs to the Chinese regulators, which will then check the code and schematics for security holes. The government says such a measure is needed to ensure that its national security isn't threatened. But Western tech giants like Microsoft, IBM, and Intel has refused to hand over any of the family jewels to China. Sharing source code in itself can't prove the capability to be secure and controllable. And Microsoft said it only proves that there is source code. Intel added that such a measure may actually decrease the security of its products and would hurt technological innovation. IBM also voiced fears that all commercial code was up for grabs rather than those products and services used by the government. Computing rooms used purely for commercial cloud computing purposes shouldn't have to be located within China borders. And IBM said that while no one is actually saying it overtly, there's also concerns that by handing over their family jewels, technology companies will be making the theft of their intellectual property so much easier. China doesn't have a good reputation at all when it comes to stealing data at once, and although neither does the United States. Microsoft has proposed that the code be examined, but only in a closed environment under high security. This suggestion was rejected by the Chinese government. Despite the objections, it's highly unlikely that any such tech biggies are going to pull out of China over the new rules. Access to what will shortly become the world's biggest market is too tempting a prize, but it is clear that a lot of the negotiation still has to be going on. The profits that you would gain by going into the markets may be there, but in the long term, you're giving away all the technology. Netflix is now allowing subscribers to do binge watching offline. Video streaming pioneer Netflix said its subscribers will now be able to download popular shows on their mobile devices at no extra cost. While many members enjoy watching Netflix at home, we've often heard they also want to continue watching on airplanes and other places where internet is expensive or limited. Netflix has expanded into almost all countries, with China being the notable exception. What is cord cutting? Cord cutting refers to the process of cutting expensive cable connections in order to change to a low-cost TV channel subscription through over-the-air free broadcast through antenna or over-the-top broadcast over the internet. Have you wondered what the broadcast over-the-air television channels are available in your area? There's a website, antennaweb.org, that's antennaweb.org. Type in your zip code, and a table will be generated which lists the stations predicted to be received at this location. The stations are sorted according to the color code antenna type needed to receive them. The list displays each station primary channel, network and distance, and direction in degrees from this location. Choose the color-coded antenna type that matches your viewing preferences. I tested with the Antop Indoor Thin HDTV antenna, which costs less than $25 at Walmart. The number of channels exceeded the predicted number of stations for the zip code. The big surprise was the number of stations received was well over 50, whereas the projected number was in the low 40 range. I was easily pulling in channels from all over the tri-state area. If you need a TV guide for these channels, there's also titantv.com. That's titantv.com, which will list the TV schedule for these channels. But what I found that was more impressive was the quality of the channel reception. Over cable subscription, the operators compress more than four channels onto the bandwidth. This results in occasional freeze frame of the image. With over-the-air telecast, the picture's clean and there's no buffering. So you've decided to drop cable TV service and rely only on over-the-air and over-the-top television broadcasts. Well, how much money do you think your cable company actually loses when you unsubscribe? If you've been considering cutting your cord, you might be surprised by just how little that television service means to heavyweights like Comcast. One Wall Street analyst did the math and determined that sometimes slashing a cable subscription only costs the company maybe $5.50. Thanks to the bundling deals that cable companies like Comcast makes oh so attractive and irresistible, the actual TV portion of many cable bills is much smaller than it might seem. Using Comcast as an example, dropping TV initially cost the company about $38. However, because of bundling and bundling discounts are eliminated by cutting the cable cord, the price of the high-speed internet service jumps by another $25. Some customers may also opt to increase the internet service speed in order to support the content streaming alternatives that are replacing their cable TV service, which further increases the price of their bill until it's virtually the same. A recent survey supports this assertion, finding that 49% of cable customers in the United States are willing to boost their internet speed in favor of dropping pay TV. The problem is further exacerbated by the fact that most cable companies hold monopolies over their respective markets. There is some overlap in certain areas, but for the most part, it's a one-provider system. None of this is news to anyone who has attempted to drop their TV service in the past while keeping the internet alive and well. But it's definitely something you got to keep in mind when you're considering cord cutting. Android Gulligan malware. It's a new variant of Android malware responsible for what's believed to be the biggest single theft of Google accounts on record. The so-called Gulligan strain has infected as many as 1.3 million Android phones since August, stealing the tokens users are given to verify they are authorized to access accounts. Its main aim is to force users into downloading apps as part of a huge advertising fraud scheme. It gains a foothold on devices when users visit a website and download a third-party app, where visitors are encouraged to download software just to gain access to content. But once downloaded, Gulligan determines which Android phone it's infected, and it launches the appropriate exploits to root the device, and that's Android 4 through 5, which includes Jelly Bean, KitKat, and Lollipop. Together, these operating systems account for 74% of Android devices in use today, totaling around 1.1 billion devices. Most infections, 40%, are in Asia, and about 19% are in North America. Once Gulligan has control of the phone, the victim's Google account token is siphoned off to a remote server and can be used to gain access to their Gmail, Docs, Drive, photos, and other data, where even two-factor authentication is turned on. So, if you are downloading a program or downloading an app, and it says you have to do downloading of content, no, don't do it. To check if your account has been breached by the Gulligan Android malware, an app from Checkpoint is available to scan your system. If the machine has the Gulligan infection, Checkpoint recommends a full clean reinstall of the system to replace the infected rootkit. Their website is Gulligan, G-O-O-L-I-G-A-N, .checkpoint.com/. Nike's has a self-lacing, they call it Hyper Adapt sneakers. Is it from the sublime to the ridiculous, or the reverse, from the ridiculous to the sublime? This was coined by Tom Paine in The Age of Reason back in 1794, in which he said the two are so closely related that it is but one step from one to the other, and the phrase has often been repeated in either order. Not having to tie your own shoelaces come at a steep price. Is this a technical solution looking for a problem? Nike introduced a pair of $720 sneaker that is self-lacing. What makes everything tick here is a system called EARL, or E-A-R-L, short for Electro-Adaptive Reactive Lacing, which activates itself as soon as your heel hits the insole. Nike calls EARL smart enough to know the amount of tightness it should provide when you lace up for the first time. The EARL mechanism makes a loud sound when triggered. When you need to adjust the laces, there are two buttons on the shoe's upper one for tightness, the other for looseness. There is a blue block on the bottom of the HyperAdapt that's used to indicate how much power you have on your shoe. A blue light means you're completely charged. Yellow is halfway, and red signals you're running low. To charge it, you use a white magnetic puck that's included in the box. Nike says the sneakers can last up to 2 weeks on a full charge. There are LEDs on the back, too, which lights up every time Earl is doing its job. Again, I ask, is this a technical solution looking for a problem? Upon reflection, the Nike self-lacing sneaker in concept is not just a back-to-the-future gimmick. For people suffering from arthritis and other health-impaired issues, putting on a pair of shoes is a major project, but at $720, it is over the top. As I had reported, there was a Black Friday special on the Dell 11-inch 3000 Inspiron for under $100. Well, to be more accurate, $99.99. I was able to order this unit on Thanksgiving Day, and the pleasant surprise was the unit arrived via FedEx at 10 p.m., pretty late at night, on Cyber Monday. That was fast. As expected, because of the limited storage of 32 gigabyte, there was no hidden partition. That meant, in case I needed to reinstall Windows 10, I had to initially create a recovery device. This is equally true if I were to replace the flash memory storage with either a hard disk drive or a solid-state drive. I downloaded the maintenance manual for the model system, and the flash memory storage is replaceable. The battery is user-replaceable, but not readily interchangeable. The memory module is removable and upgradable. I strongly recommend that with any purchase of a personal computer system, download the maintenance manual so you can find out what is contained in it that will tell you what is upgradable. Although this is a newly purchased Windows 10 system, it had one thing in common with many other who had converted from Windows 7, 8, or 8.1 to Windows 10. And in each case, you don't have a copy of the Windows 10 for reinstallation or recovery or restore. Microsoft Windows OS distribution is being transitioned to the separate creation of the OS by the user. With this unit, there was no hidden partition, but that did not prevent Dell from installing bloatware. However, with the creation of the recovery media, the bloatware is not carried forward, but there is the option to retain the personal data. The process is fairly simple, but it's very time-consuming. Step 1, and this is not in the manual, change your power option setting to never for turn off the display and never for put the computer to sleep. Otherwise, the process will abort on the timeout. Step 2, go to control panel. Step 3, go to recovery. Step 4, create a recovery drive and just follow instructions. You have to be very patient, though, when creating the recovery drive onto a USB flash drive. I recommend using 16 gigabytes or more. It could be a fast process, but if you are creating the recovery drive onto an external hard drive or solid-state drive, the drive is formatted first before the process starts. Getting back to the Black Friday special, has almost all the features I wanted with the exception of an RJ45 or Ethernet port. I can and I will probably purchase a USB Ethernet dongle for about $13. If I wanted to upgrade the memory from 2 gigabytes to 4 gigabytes, that's another $20. Finally, if I wanted to run with more storage, well, that's another $45. I could have gotten a highly equipped PC for about the same Black Friday special with all the extras added. I am disappointed that there was not a single Chromebook Black Friday special. This begs a much larger question. What is the future of the Chromebook? Is a Chromebook a tablet? Chromebook has the body of a basic inexpensive laptop, including a keyboard and trackpad, but operate more like a tablet. They run Google Chrome OS, an operating system that is a web browser. Is a Chromebook an Android device? Well, Google recently announced the app runtime for Chrome, which allows developers to adapt their Android apps to Chrome OS. Do Android apps work on a Chromebook? On some Chromebooks, you can download the Android apps from the Google Play Store, and you can run Android apps on your Chromebook with the app runtime for Chrome. However, this program is in beta. This feature works on some Chromebooks running Chrome OS version 37 and higher. What is the operating system of the Chromebook? A Chromebook is a laptop of a different breed. Instead of Windows 10 or Mac OS X, Chromebooks runs Chrome OS. These machines are designed to be used primarily while connected to the internet, with most applications and documents living in the cloud. When buying a computer, do you buy an operating system and ask what applications are available? Or do you first define what applications you want and then ask what operating systems support those functions? An operating system is system software that manages computer hardware and software resources and provides common services for computer programs. All computer programs, excluding firmware, require an operating system to function. An application program, on the other hand, is a computer program designed to form a group of coordinated functions. In reality, in answer to that question, it's somewhere in the middle. Application developers will develop applications for a larger user base first, and, well, are you using the computer for a specific application, or are you using the computer for support of general computing needs? What does the installed base look like today? On the operating system front, Windows has dropped below the 90% market share for the first time in years. In 2016, shipments of Chromebooks outpaced Macs in the United States for the first time. It represented 13% market share and accounted for a 5.6 increase year over year in sales. Chrome OS has become a low-key success story for Google in the last few years because they are relatively cheap, easy to track, and manage. Chromebooks have made inroads in businesses and educational institutions, but Chrome OS still has a big shortcoming compared to Windows and Mac OS, its core applications. The future of computing is hybrid. Phones have become tablets. Tablets have become desktop computers with keyboards. So where are we today with Chromebooks? In a short span of 3 years, Chromebooks having less than 1% of the market to now over 50% of the education market share in the United States. Chrome OS sales in the United States outpaced Mac for the first time in the first quarter of this year, and Apple has been losing ground to Google Chromebook in the education market. The Play Store comes to Chrome OS, but not the way we're expecting. To help close that gap and augment web apps, Google has introduced the Chrome Apps platform to let developers make web apps that look and function more like traditional standalone apps. Part of the Google sales pitch was that Chrome apps were universal, without any additional effort from developers. These apps would run not just on Chrome OS, but also on Windows, Mac, or Linux PC with Chrome installed. However, there has been some confusion about the future of Chrome OS and Chromebooks based on the suggestion that Chrome OS would be folded into Android. The future of computing is hybrid. Phones have become tablets. Tablets have become desktop computers with desktops. The status of Google laptop operating system strategy is in flux. If you're planning to buy a Chromebook or already own one, you could be wondering whether your laptop is going to stop receiving OS support sometime in the next few years. You should still be able to use your Chromebook no matter how Chrome OS morphs, and almost as many reasons to think Chrome isn't going to go anywhere for quite some time. Google has said that there are no plans to phase out Chrome OS. Of course, a little skepticism doesn't hurt when it comes to Google. But new Chromebooks do keep coming, and Google says it's continuing to develop new features for Chrome while emphasizing the security that's built into the OS. Support will continue until 2020. Continual OS support is crucial to keeping your laptop going. As for Chrome Google's end-of-life policy, it includes a list of Chrome devices that promise support until 2020. Most Chromebook apps are web-based. Chromebooks are cheap, at least partly because they were built to run simple apps. Most of those apps are web-based, which means you'll be able to continue running them on other devices and platforms. Your files are stored in the cloud anyway. Doing everything online is the whole idea behind the Chromebook. That includes the apps you use. And it also includes file storage and the ability to access your data from anywhere on a variety of devices. To that end, all your files, photos, videos, and any other data are stored on Google servers. So even if the worst happens and your Chromebook becomes completely obsolete, you'll still be able to access your stuff with Chrome and Chromebooks. It's all about being connected. Just remember, whenever you're connected, NSA can get at your data. More emphasis on Android is inevitable, but consider what's been happening with other operating systems. Apple has in many ways merged iOS with Mac OS, and Windows has become significantly more focused on mobile in the past few years. Google itself has been working on porting Android apps to Chrome for some time. Android on Chrome could mean better apps. Whether Google eliminates Chrome and moves to Android-only devices, or if it somehow merges the two operating systems, the change would make it easier and more attractive for developers to come up with Android apps for Chromebooks, and that should be good for the consumer. So why weren't Chromebooks at Black Friday special this holiday season? Google remains committed to the platform, but things have been awfully quiet lately. Black Friday and Cyber Monday have come and gone, and the holiday shopping season is in full swing. Google's trying something different this year. The company has a full ecosystem of products made in-house for the first time. The Pixel smartphone, Google Home Assistant, and Daydream virtual reality headset. All three are important to Google's strategy, but in the humble Chromebook, it seemed to have been gone neglected. Chromebooks outsold Macs in the first quarter of the year. Yeah, that shows that there's a market for Chromebooks, and that market is growing. The second development was Google's announcement that Android apps would come to Chromebooks this year. That would solve two of the platform's big weaknesses, the lack of traditional applications and the Chromebook's limited offline applications. But the rollout of Google Play on Chromebooks has been stilted at best. Only three models have full support as of today, and more than 6 months after Google announced the feature. There are few more that can run Android apps if you use the developer version of Chrome OS, but ultimately this isn't a selling point. Google can use to drive interest in the platform, but ultimately this isn't a selling point that Google can use to drive interest in the platform. It's hard to see this as anything but a missed opportunity. Android is the most popular mobile OS by a wide margin, and being able to use the same apps on both your mobile phone and Chromebook would bring a nice layer of integration to the two platforms. But this non-launch means that consumers aren't aware of this potentially important feature, and developers have zero incentive to consider Chromebooks when building apps. One possible explanation could be that the company is fully merging Chrome OS with Android. That would certainly explain the silence, and an announcement of that magnitude would likely wait until next year. Until Chromebooks becomes high priority to Google, it will continue to have a hard time shaking that only a browser stigma. And with time running out, that's a wrap for the week. The website for the Personal Computer Show is pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at pcradio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York. We will be on live next week, and we will be taking telephone calls. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing. And remember, backup, backup, and backup. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Until we meet again, same station, same time, next week. Happy computing and good night.